Hi guys, great to be with you. I'm Michael Millerman, millermanschool.com. Just thought I'd do a quick little catch-up video, let you know what I've been thinking about lately, and we get back into the rhythm here of speaking with one another. So like all of you, I assume, I'm watching the daily news with great interest and amazement. Every day there's something new. You know, there's an old idea, to combine the new and the old in a way that I think is always useful to do. There's an old idea that law and technology are at odds with one another. And they're at odds with one another in the following very specific way, that technology moves faster than the law. It's something that even Peter Thiel said when he was remarking about the early days of PayPal. He said that, you know, the law hadn't yet been established to deal with these new payments systems. And he said in one of his interviews, as long as the technology could stay ahead of the law, they would be fine. You know, they could grow their company faster than the law could regulate. Now, we've just come out of an era where there was the threat that regulation would suffocate technological development. You know that with Biden and Kamala and debanking and all of the laws against crypto companies, just the general atmosphere of regulatory suffocation that now Elon Musk and Doge and David Sachs and Marc Andreessen and all of these people are helping to remove, right? You're removing the regulatory blanket and you are freeing the energies, innovation, enterprise, dynamism, the American spirit. It's a time to build. You can only have builders building if you don't have regulatory hurdles stopping them at every step. Okay, so on one hand, you have, call it technology, and that's going to be our dynamism, innovation, enterprise, and so on. On the other hand, you have law. And there's this old idea, like I said, repeated in current times by Peter Thiel when he said that PayPal has to stay ahead of the law. Okay, not an outlaw in the sense that the law is established and you're breaking it, but something else. You're ahead of the law. The law hasn't caught up to you yet. So you're not an outlaw in one sense, not in the criminal sense, just in this other sense. So the old idea is that this puts technology and law at odds with one another in a way that teaches us that technology poses a threat to social order. Now, let's connect the dots here. Why does technology pose a threat to social order? Because social order depends on there being good laws that people follow. And people follow the law if they have a habit of being law-abiding. In other words, laws establish habits and they require the habit of being lawful. Technology is always upending habits. It's always creating new situations. Innovation means the replacement of the old, whereas the law depends on the authority of the old. And that helps you to understand why, in some cases, law is considered not only to be old, but to be the oldest of the old, to be God-given a long time ago and for all time. So Moses, Muhammad, religious codes of law are premised on the view, you could say, that I'm going to now give you a formulation from Leo Strauss. The old or ancestral is the good. The further back you go, the better it gets. That means that our ancestors, in the best case, were gods or sons of gods. And in other words, that the source of our social and political cohesion, the law, was given not by man, but by a god or gods or a representative or messenger of God. Incidentally, that's why Plato's book on law, called The Laws, begins with the question among the characters. One character asks another character, who do you say gave you your laws, God or man? That's an old question. Is the source of law man, or is the source of law something higher than man, better than man, wiser than man, older than man? And in the best case, the creator of man. Okay, so law, the phenomenon of law, in the best case scenario, is old good laws that people follow. Now, you might say, well, what if there's an old bad law? Then you change it, right? You improve the law. Can't there be improvements to the law? I mean, do we think that we live in a time that clearly recognizes that innovation can be an improvement? And so shouldn't we be constantly improving upon the law? It's an interesting question. Aristotle himself suggested that in some cases, you know, it's even better to leave an imperfect law than to try to improve every law all the time. Because think about the effect of constantly changing the law. The effect on the people is a habit that the law, you don't have to follow the law because it's going to change anyways. It's not its best version. Who cares? These laws are made by stupid people and they're stupid laws. Therefore, we don't have to follow them. Tomorrow, there's going to be a better one. The day after tomorrow, there's going to be an even better one. So constant innovation produces a habit of disobedience to the law or of disregard for the law. Just a habit of disobedience. You can understand that. It's kind of conceptually and logically follows with follows from the idea of innovation. So this tension between technology and law deserves our attention. It's established in Plato and Aristotle as a theme worthy of study. It's repeated by Peter Thiel in our times. And we see it at the same time because we live in an age where technology is moving fast and breaking things. Law as this social order had become an oppressive administrative, managerial, bureaucratic, regulatory straitjacket. And that went too far, clearly. And it's an extremely exciting and interesting time now to see the liberation of dynamism, of American dynamism, right now in particular. So yeah, that's one topic that I'm thinking about as I watch what's happening at the moment with Doge and with the tech right in the Trump administration. Amazing things. You should know there's this book called The Sovereign Individual written in the 80s, in the 2000 version of it. Peter Thiel wrote the introduction, a little preface or something like that. And even in that book, The Sovereign Individual, which is all about, keeping in mind 1980s, okay, all about these new technologies and what they're going to mean for state sovereignty and state power. So for example, if you own a house, you know, the state can really exert its monopoly on the legitimate use of violence and extract property taxes from you and extract other resources from you. In other words, the state is very extractive. It's an extractive entity. It robs you. Or let's say it sucks your blood or whatever you want to, you don't have to necessarily be so quite so negative about it, but it's for sure extractive, okay? Extracts resources through taxation. And at some point it goes too far, nobody likes that, and you have the counter-strike from the point of view of individual liberty and the technological apparatus that helps serve individual liberty. Okay, so one of these things also go hand in hand. If I said law was an important component of social and political order because it sets the customs, mores, habits, directions, opinions about good, bad, right, wrong, and all of that, and requires a habit of obedience, a sort of a communal or common thing, the law. Technology, in some senses, liberates individuality in the possibilities of individual action. So in the Sovereign Individual book, that thesis is developed. That, for example, I can't put my house in my pocket and go across the border. So if my resources are invested in my house, I'm not so mobile. I'm subject to state extraction and so on. But if I have Bitcoin, I can put my Bitcoin in my pocket, so to speak, and cross the border, and it's harder for the state to take it from me. Okay, so that's sort of, but why I mention is because towards the end of the book, The Sovereign Individual, the author says that although technology is proceeding so quickly, and although these new tech elites are developing ever clever ways to liberate individuality, we add here parenthetically, together with infringements on privacy in some cases, and at the same time, attempts to preserve privacy. So I have friends in Bitcoin developers who are working on cryptographic solutions to privacy problems and so on. So both the threat to privacy and the attempt to have additional privacy measures are included in this tech dimension. But the authors of The Sovereign Individual say, at the same time, we haven't progressed morally beyond the laws of Moses. beyond the teachings of Confucius. Morally, the old somehow is the better. And technologically, the new is the better. And a tech society, in favoring the new, risks losing what's good about the old. And a traditional society, in favoring the old, risks undermining what's good about the new. And so you could say that the tension between the tech right and the trad right, a theme that we've covered on this channel several times, has something to do with this tension between law and technology. That's another way of looking at it, potentially. And you don't want a world that's all technology and no law. Or maybe you do, but that sounds like potentially one extreme. You don't want a world that's all law and no technology. Maybe you do, but it sounds like potentially that's another extreme. And so how do you find the sweet spot between innovation and habitual obedience to good laws customarily received and wisely given? All right, so, okay, I figured we'd do a spontaneous video. That's what came to mind to talk to you about. So that's one of the things I'm watching. Things are happening very, very quickly in politics, aren't they? And it's giving you, if you're an investor, it's giving you, at times, I think, an investable thesis. The new nature of the world order should be giving you, if you're into the markets, an investable thesis. So for instance, I think that it's Palantir, for instance, that has done so well. Their stock was up 20% or so yesterday after a stellar earnings report. Even if you're not a quantitative financial analyst, you still could have predicted, I think, that given the nature of the Trump coalition and given the nature of Palantir's political philosophy, which you could learn about by listening to interviews given by the CEO Alex Karp or by reading the book The Technological Republic when it comes out. I was lucky enough to get an early copy, but again, you could even have read, which we did on this channel, Alex Karp's Time Magazine op-ed called Silicon Valley Has a Harvard Problem. And this would tell you sort of, you know, this is what Palantir is with their morally serious worldview and up-to-date technological know-how. This is what the Trump administration represents. And it was sort of an investable thesis, I would say, that Palantir would grow. And that other defense stocks too, some privately held, some publicly held. So I'm looking at that. That's really fascinating. All of the AI news. So let me just say something here, parenthetically, so to speak. An interest in markets, finance, economics, companies, trends, and tendencies of a kind of technological kind, they're legitimate, in my opinion, from a philosophical perspective, as well as just a human perspective, in several different ways and for several different reasons. I just want to give you one, okay? Philosophy traditionally can be understood as a serious, sustained, fundamental inquiry into the comprehensive whole. Man, nature, time, history, the gods, God, cause, effect, what is anything at all? What does it mean to be? What's the relationship between being and nothing? Okay, ethics, aesthetics, logic, religion, everything. Comprehensive, fundamental inquiry in a serious and sustained way into the comprehensive whole. Something like that, okay? And there are other kinds of inquiry that also have a comprehensive character to them, okay? Where in order to learn about one thing, you learn about more things and you start to see the inner relationship and you start to broaden your scope and somehow more and more is included in your field of vision, in your area of interest, and it's somehow humanizing to be exposed to a deep inquiry, even if it's not necessarily the deepest inquiry, or into a comprehensive field, even if it's not the most comprehensive field. Something about that is humanizing, elevating, ennobling, dignifying, exciting, and pleasant. So right now, I think technology, finance, politics, and all of that is offering you a field for that. Politics has always offered a field for comprehensive reflection. Leo Strauss makes this point in his Aristotle chapter in the book called The City and Man, that for Aristotle, the regime was the comprehensive political phenomenon. In a liberal democratic regime, in a fascist regime, in a communist regime, okay, to use contemporary language, in an aristocratic regime, in a democracy, in a tyranny, to use older language, the regime type affects pretty much every part of life. It affects the education, you know, it affects all kinds of things. The nature of the regime casts its shadow on manifold phenomena. Okay, so it has its comprehensiveness makes it attractive to those who, out of a philosophical interest, like things that are consequential and broad and simultaneously deep and important. Okay, money is sort of like that. There's a part of Plato's Laws. Okay, I'll give me like five more minutes. Okay, then I'll wrap this up. There's a part of Plato's Republic, or let's say there's a general notion in Plato that money has a kind of universality to it, which is a certain kind of quasi-philosophical universality, or a parody of philosophical universality, or a vulgar distortion of philosophical universality. But nevertheless, it has a certain sort of universality to it. Okay, the idea is that if I have a skill, okay, they call it an art or a skill, like the skill of shoemaking or the art of shoemaking, okay, the skill of knife making, okay, the art of knife making, right? If I have some skill, some technical skill, I have to know that skill very well. For example, teaching, singing, dancing, speaking, building, designing, right? You name it, boom, 100 different skills a person could be expert in. But together with each of those, there's another skill that gets added if you want to be successful in some sense. The skill of money making. So the shoemaker has to know how to make shoes, and he also has to know how to make money. The painter has to know how to paint. He also has to know how to make money. Okay, this is recognized by Plato. This isn't, we're not talking about late stage capitalism or something like that, okay? I'm not BlackRock. Okay, we're telling you this old idea that together with every specific art, there's sort of the general art of money making that attends it. And the idea is that this general art of money making, it has a kind of universality to it. It's not the same, to repeat, as the universality of wisdom or something like that, but it's there too. So I find when you study markets, if you're just watching the news, however you watch the news, okay, a couple of weeks ago. But take the last couple of weekends, okay? Last week, it was a tariff threat. Trump, 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Okay, now you begin. What is a tariff? How do tariffs work? Do tariffs make it more or less expensive? Which products get tariffed? How's Canada going to respond? How's Mexico going to respond? How's China going to respond? Because I think he did threaten 10% tariff on Chinese goods. Okay, how do these responses affect what happens when I go to the store to buy something? I was talking to my kids about this, right? There was like, okay, Florida orange juice is going to become more expensive. Canadian liquor stores pulled U.S. booze off the shelf. I don't very much care about liquor and booze, but you start to think about it. Okay, auto manufacturing chains. What's not going to happen? We were thinking about buying a bigger car for the families. That can become more expensive. How does this affect that, affect the other thing? And you start with a small data point, tariffs announced, and suddenly, boom, you have an inquiry into a system, into a large comprehensive system, and not a system that is indifferent to us, but a system where if you don't have enough money, you don't eat. If trade goes down, you got fired. If you have retaliatory trades, maybe they escalate. Trade war can become a shooting war. What does it mean to be Canadian if national identity of Canada is now going to be, you know, are you a traitor if you support Trump at the same time as he's threatening tariffs on Canada and you think that Trudeau is a total bum and that the Canadian government is not only incompetent, but non-existent at the moment? So suddenly a data point becomes a large inquiry. Take 2 weeks ago or whenever it was, 3 weeks ago. Okay, on the weekend, everybody was writing about DeepSeek. DeepSeek, Chinese version of ChatGPT. Okay, in a sentence. So DeepSeek came out, and the idea was, oh, look, this new large language model is showing many different things. It's showing that China can compete with the best tech of the United States, and it's showing that they could do it at a much lower cost. And now the whole AI thesis in the United States with OpenAI's multi-billion-dollar valuation and SoftBank and all of these sorts of things. Oracle, if you remember that meeting between Oracle, SoftBank, and OpenAI announcing $500 billion program, of AI research and expansion and all of that, keep the United States at the forefront. And I guess Chinese are doing it better. They're doing it better for a penny on the dollar. Okay. Now you have an opportunity for reflection. Is that really what happened? How many servers did they use or did they say they use? Are they lying about the details because NVIDIA can't sell its servers directly to China, so they're getting them through whatever, Singapore, something like that. How's this going to affect, how's A going to affect B, B going to affect C, C going to affect D, and how's all of this going to matter to me and to my country and to my friends and to my family or to strangers? It's just intellectually interesting, I find, isn't it? And this wasn't my view beforehand, but somebody did suggest to me and I've sort of come around to this to a certain extent that markets are a place where you can test the thesis and get real world feedback. Now, that's not the only place where you can do that. You know, it's not the only place. And all sort of maybe all engineering systems give you a chance to get real world feedback. And, you know, if you say something to your girlfriend and she slaps you in the face, that's real world feedback. So there's, you know, there are many different kinds of real world feedback that you can get from your ideas or from your opinions. But there's something. Now, don't get me wrong. Before, when I expressed an interest in my, I've been called a sophist. Oh, you know, sophists take money for the teaching and this, that, and everything. If, you know, you're materialistic if you care about money. I can give you a whole big backstory on this. I don't want to go too far into details, but I'll say this. Some people are born so crassly materialistic that for them, evolution means becoming more spiritual. And some people are born so ethereal and head in the clouds that evolution for them means getting grounded, coming back down to earth. And it's evolution in both cases. Just one is one evolves by coming back down to earth. Another evolves by going up into the subtle spiritual domains. So what's the right answer? It's better to go up or down? Well, show me who we're talking about. Same with money, okay? Somebody is so obsessed with money that he needs to sell everything. And he needs to, you know, he was a prince. He was in the king's palace and he was always surrounded by luxury. He needs to sell everything and he needs to go live in the mountains alone with nothing. Kill his food with his own hands and all the rest of it. That for him is going to be progress and evolution. Somebody else, he's going to find that he gets an understanding of other people and of management and of leadership and so on. He's going to develop what Aristotle called the virtue of magnificence only as he acquires resources, you know, only being in charge of resources. He needs to become a man of the world and he needs to increase his worldly wisdom. Okay. So you have these different attitudes, okay? But the market is one place where if you have an idea, again, obviously you either have to have money or you have to be working for someone who has money to do this, but where you say, look, this is what it looks like to me is happening in the world, and therefore this is what I can predict is going to happen with the companies and markets. And if you're right, you get some interesting feedback. If you're wrong, you get some interesting feedback and you have something at stake. So again, I'm just sharing to you that for me personally, that has become interesting. Because I teach political philosophy. If you watch this channel, you know I teach political philosophy. Heidegger, Derrida, Schmidt, Strauss, all these people. And over the last few years, the demand for what I know or what I, you know, I don't, for what I like to discuss with you has come from people in finance who believe that understanding Dugin will help them see the shape of the world order tomorrow. And understanding the shape of the world order tomorrow will help them not only with the personal satisfaction of understanding things, but will also help them plan where to invest and at where to allocate their resources. It's just interesting. So yeah. Okay, technology and law, we discussed a little bit. Law as being, you know, man-made versus given by God, right? Law and innovation. Does law have to be the oldest thing? If it's oldest and best, it has to be from somebody higher than us, from a God or from somebody who has communicated with a God. Again, this Platonic thesis. And you see it in the monotheisms. Pretty amazing, by the way. The more general reflection about law and technology that you see in Aristotle, as I said, right, that technology undermines our habit of obedience to the law, and that can be a problem. And we fast forward to the sovereign individual, and we have that stated another way, that technology liberates us from the violence of the state, but at the same time, it leaves us morally illiterate if we haven't made much progress beyond Moses and Confucius and we think that what's old is bad, because one of the axioms of constant innovation is that the new is the good and the old is the bad. One of the premises of traditionalism is that the old is the good and the new is the bad. But in fact, some new things are good, some new things are bad, some old things are good, some old things are bad, and therefore you have to find the right sort of intelligent synthesis between the tech, right, innovation is good, and the trad, right, the old is what's good. And if you can do that, then good for you. You know, that's a sweet spot. One of the things Aristotle said about the virtues, you know, is there's one way to get it right and several ways to get it wrong. You know, if you take a line, right, the line has one center and it has many points that are not the center. One way to get it perfectly right and many ways to get it wrong, but you can be wrong, you know, in better or worse ways. So if you've enjoyed this video and you like hearing about the connection of philosophy to politics and reflections on technology, I'm happy to hear that. I encourage you to subscribe to the channel. If you like the video and you comment on the video, as I'm sure you've heard a million times before on other people's channels, it'll help the channel to grow. When the channel grows, I'm more inspired and encouraged to make videos like this, even though, you know, I'll make them when I feel like it, even if the channel's not growing. And if you want my courses on these topics, you should go to millermanschool.com. I have a Substack where I write from time to time. It's millermanschool.substack.com, I think. And if you know anybody who you think would like this video, share it with them, etc. Follow me on Twitter, m_Millerman. I post probably too often and without a filter, but that's what makes Twitter fun, isn't it? Yeah, that's about it. So great being with you guys. It's an amazing time. Oh, I just want to say one other thing, actually, which is this. If you're like me, you're fascinated by what's happening in politics today. There's no question. It's extremely entertaining. For some of you, not for most of you, I would think, but for some of you, it could be really disheartening. You might hate it. You still can't look away. And for some of you, it might just be the greatest days of your life watching politics, which I think is probably more likely given the people who watch this channel. But nobody can dispute that it's extremely addictive, extremely interesting, and it's just, you can't look away. And at the same time, you know, you also have your life, right? So unless, I mean, some of you may be in Washington, some of you may be in the State Department, you may be in the White House. Guys, you'd be surprised who watches this channel. So if you're in the field, if you're in the arena, then you do you, needless to say. And thank you for your service and thank you for your work. And you're setting an example for all of us, including us here in Canada. But if you're just somewhere and you're watching this with your popcorn and enjoying it, that's fine. Nobody wants to deprive you of your enjoyment. And after all, especially if you voted for Trump or if you like Trumpism, then, you know, you're giving it your popular support by following it, by watching it, by commenting it. But don't forget that you also have your life closer to you. I don't mean to assume that you are forgetting about this, and excuse me for moralizing or editorializing for a minute, but just don't forget about the life that's in your ambit, in your control, you know? Take care of yourself, take care of your health, take care of your family. You know, go for runs, go for walks, go for jogs. Watch your diet, control your mood. If you're really distraught at what's happening in politics, don't let it drive you completely crazy. You know, read a nice book, mellow out. Yeah, fight the good fight, but don't sacrifice yourself so completely that you're more worried about what's happening in Washington than you are about, you know, your family members in the other room or whatever the case is. So I think that's just, I just wanted to say that, okay, because especially what's happening now in politics, I can imagine never wanting to put down the phone, never wanting to close the computer, never wanting to turn off the news. But, you know, last weekend I went snowboarding with my kids. It's such a great time. It's something that I think I'll never forget, unless I get Alzheimer's or whatever, get bonked in the head. So create little moments that you can cherish regardless of what's happening in politics. Enjoy the things that you can enjoy regardless of what's happening in politics. Okay, stop and smell the roses, enjoy your morning coffee, and wow, right? That's all I can say about what's happening today. So I hope you like this video. Thanks for spending time together. I'm Michael Millerman. Guys, take care, be well, goodbye.